On May 4, 2025, at the Bozeman Events Center, Bozeman Tenants United hosted an informational panel about their campaign to institute a tenant's right to counsel in Bozeman. It featured the coordinator of the National Coalition for the Civil Rights to Counsel, John Pollack, who had just flown in from Alabama, Bozeman Tenants United organizer Connie Howell, Montana Legal Services Association Senior Attorney for Housing, Amy Hall, HRDC's Emergency and Supportive Housing Director, Brian Geyer, Charlie Cromwell, Managing Partner of Cromwell Law, as well as MSU Adjunct Professor, and who has been providing legal services via the ASMSU Legal Services Program, and Bozeman Deputy Mayor, Joey Morrison. The panel was moderated by Bozeman Tenants United Campaigns Director, Olive Sohn.
My name is Olive, and I'm the Campaigns Director for Bozeman Tenants United. Since I was a kid, I've never had control over the place that matters most to me, my home. And so that's why I choose to wake up every day and fight with the tenant union, because I'm tired at being at the mercy of a housing system that prioritizes profit over the lives of homes and people like me. Over the last 4 years, I've had my rent double and the conditions of my home degrade every single time I've moved. And I've been threatened with eviction by a corporate landlord whose grounds were made up clauses that did not exist in my lease. And I know that they would not be doing that if they thought that I could fight back against them, if they thought that I had a right to a lawyer. And I know that I am not alone in this. I'm not at all. Every week, I talk to my neighbors who are skimping on their groceries because their rent is too damn high, who put up with black mold, water leaks, and faulty appliances in their apartments because they're afraid if they submit a maintenance request that they're going to face eviction, who are living on the streets of Bozeman because they have an eviction on the record and they can't get back into housing. Winning safe, dignified, and truly affordable housing, that is the work of our tenant union. Since launching at the end of 2022, we've fought against corporations using our homes as profit, like Airbnb and VRBO, and won a ban on second home short-term rentals. We knocked 15,000 doors to elect the first tenant mayor in our city, and we've been building unions in apartment buildings like Bridger Peaks Apartments and fighting with seniors who live there to win critical repairs from their corporate landlord, Devco. And now, 2 years later, we are fighting for every tenant in Bozeman to have legal representation in eviction court. Corporate greed is ruining our country, it's ruining our state of Montana, and it's ruining our city of Bozeman. Corporate landlords like 11 Capital that own thousands and thousands of units across state lines, across our country, they are the biggest evictors in Bozeman. They use their fancy legal teams to evict us and our neighbors, while tenants, like in 2023, tenants in Bozeman could only afford legal representation 6% of the time. That ain't right. The result of this is that the deck is stacked for corporate evictors and against tenants in a legal system that is meant to be navigated by lawyers. It's estimated that in Bozeman, 40% of evicted households are households with children. That ain't right. And I spoke last week with a mother who was evicted last year, who spent months living on the streets of Bozeman with her 5- and 9-year-old children. As a result of the eviction, not only did that family lose their home, but she lost her job, she had to drop out of college, and her kids had to change schools twice. That ain't right. The solution is simple. We need equal legal representation in court to keep us in our homes. Our tenant union is committed to eventually winning a right to counsel for every single tenant in Bozeman that is facing eviction. But because of budget constraints, we're fighting for a program this year that prioritizes families with children. On June 10th, the City Commission has an opportunity to level the playing field between landlords and tenants and include $314,000 in their budget for an intro program to tenant right to counsel. So today, we are going to hear from nationally recognized expert on right to counsel, John Pollock of the National Coalition of Civil Right to Counsel, about what tenant right to counsel is and how it has worked in the 26 municipalities that have implemented it across the country. After we hear from John, we're going to hear from this amazing panel up here of experts on eviction and right to counsel. And we've compiled a list of the most frequently asked questions about right to counsel. Let's get rolling. I'm going to pass it to John.
My organization, the National Coalition for Civil Right to Counsel, has worked with all of the 26 jurisdictions that have passed right to counsel and about another 140 that are on the path to right to counsel. I'll talk about that a little bit later. We basically are here to help you accomplish what you want to accomplish. That's our goal. We are a community-centered movement. We don't come in and say, here's what you should do. Our role is to support you all in what you want to accomplish for your communities and to be there to listen to what the community wants and help you find that route. That's our whole model. The thing about right to counsel is that on the one hand, the Supreme Court has been incredibly hostile to the idea of a right to counsel in civil cases. Everyone probably knows from watching Law and Order that if you are arrested and you can't afford a lawyer, you get one. You've heard that the Miranda warning, if you can't afford one, one will be given to you. In civil cases, it's actually a different story. There are two times where the court had a chance to find a right to counsel, and both times it said no. One was permanent termination of parental rights, and one of them was a parent who could not pay child support and was jailed for it. And in both of those situations, the court said no right to counsel. That's the backdrop that we work against. But the states are free to do what they want, and they can go above what the Supreme Court has said. Even if the Supreme Court said there's no right, they can actually, under their own constitution, say there is, or they can pass one legislatively. And in fact, they've done that. And I'm here to tell you today that right to counsel is so common at this point. Like, it's actually much more common than people realize. We're going to talk about housing a lot today, but just as context, that same issue I just mentioned, termination of parental rights, the vast majority of states have said there is a right to counsel. They've either passed a statute or their court said, we don't care what the Supreme Court said under our constitution, we feel that this is a right. So when parents are facing child welfare proceedings, termination of parental rights, adoption, for mental health cases where people are being involuntarily treated, for truancy for children, for quarantine, these are all civil areas where the states have broadly found a right to counsel. And that's something people don't realize. You'll often see in the news, like you'll see, it'll say something like, you know, because there's no right to counsel in civil cases, that's absolutely not true. There's just no federal right to counsel, but the states have done a lot to create a right to counsel. And your court here in Montana has actually been one of the better ones on right to counsel. Actually, it's recognized it a few times, including cases that we were involved in. Right to counsel and evictions. So as you heard before, there are 26 jurisdictions that have passed right to counsel, 19 at the city level, 2 county, 5 state. In just 8 years. That's pretty miraculous. That's a speed that is almost unprecedented for a movement to go that quickly. So before 2017, not one place in the country had a right to counsel for tenants facing eviction. New York City was the first in 2017. New York City has about 250,000 eviction filings a year. Their right to counsel costs about $200 million, and it's underfunded. Just think about that for a minute. It costs $200 million, and it's significantly underfunded. They have to hire about 800, 900 lawyers for their right to counsel. When a city like that can pass right to counsel, it certainly opens the door to places that are not that large, that don't have the scale of that problem. So New York doing that was huge. New York was an organizing victory. It was the Right to Counsel New York City Coalition that drove that effort in New York and made it happen. There were many other people that participated, but it was the organizing that helped it cross the finish line. And it's worth noting that in the jurisdictions that we work in, 21 of them are red states, actually, with 81 jurisdictions in those red states that are working on right to counsel. This is not like an East Coast, West Coast deal. We're working all over the country. Like right now, we're working in Salt Lake City. We're working in Boise. We're working in Las Vegas, Akron, Ohio. Like, this is all over the country. This is not like these little isolated pockets of resistance. This is actually a movement that is coming across the whole country. I will tell you, I've been doing this since 2009. And when I first started, people were like, right to counsel? That's a joke, right? Like, you're not serious. Like, people would literally say that to me when I started. Or they'd say, like, this is a pipe dream. Or they'd say, didn't the Supreme Court already kill that? Isn't that dead? Like, didn't they already dispose of that issue? In 2021, there was a poll done by Law 360 And that poll found that the majority of people across all political alignments supported a right to counsel for tenants facing eviction. That is unreal to have that shift from 2009 to 2021. Again, the result of people like you here changing minds, changing hearts, like raising awareness, making them understand this is an extremely critical issue that has to be dealt with now. And besides the general public, we've seen stakeholder support from a wide variety of very mainstream supporters like the American Bar Association, the United Way, the Legal Services Corporation, the Federal Reserve, the National League of Cities. These are not radical groups. These are very middle of the road, a lot of them very mainstream groups, and they've come behind right to counsel. Even some landlords have actually started to back right to counsel. And in fact, in New York State, the Real Estate Board of New York, which is the largest trade industry in the state, filed testimony in support of a statewide right to counsel in New York and encouraged the city of New York to expand its right to counsel, which is, again, just, yeah, an incredible shift. And we're seeing, as right to counsel gets implemented, the landlords are saying, this is actually helping us, because if we have a bad relationship with our tenant, we don't want to have to do that directly. We want an arm's length. We want an attorney to deal with. And that actually, they see that as a benefit to them. It's not making the case take tremendously longer. And for landlords that don't want to have to evict someone, you know, for landlords who actually say, like, they're a small landlord, that it's personal, it actually makes it easier for them to have an attorney to deal with. It actually, so there, a lot of them are starting to talk about seeing that benefit. What are the justifications for right to counsel? You heard one of them earlier. I think it was 6%, the representation rate in Bozeman. That's actually higher than the national average. The national average is about 4%. In some places, it's less than 1% of tenants that have counsel. In one jurisdiction we worked in, it was 0.1% of tenants that had counsel. Landlord average is about 84% around the country. So just a huge, huge mega disparity. As we say, that's not a gap, that's a chasm of representational difference. And when you have a system like that, the courts basically shift to serve the party with counsel. That's what happens, because the attorney for the landlord is there every single day. They get to be familiar with the court, they get to be familiar with the judge. It becomes a very familiar relationship. One of the things that we often see is, like, landlord attorneys will say, like, you know, judge, can you schedule this, like, now, because I've got to be somewhere else. If a tenant tried to say that, like, you know, I've got to get to work, or I've got kids, I've got to get out of daycare, they're not going to rearrange the schedule for a tenant, but they will for the landlord's attorney, because, again, that relationship exists and they've been there a lot. That's a result of one side having representation and the other side not. The next big justification is the harm of eviction. I don't think I need to explain to you all here what the harms of eviction are, so I'm just going to give you some statistics, because statistics really speak to just how severe it is. Some of the impacts of losing your home: health, which is one that's increasingly being talked about, is the negative consequences of health. One study found, so during the pandemic, there was a moratorium on evictions that the federal government issued. And during that time, they found that there was a 16% reduction in physical abuse, 21% reduction in sexual abuse, and 12% reduction in child neglect, just from an eviction moratorium. These were consequences that basically evictions cause. And one recent study found that tenants are 3 times more likely to be subjected to violence than homeowners are. This is just part of the experience. Some of that is through the eviction itself. Some of that is just the relationship of being a tenant. Schools, children's schools, a study recently found that school children threatened with eviction are more likely to end up in another district or transfer to another school, often one with less funding, more poverty, and lower test scores. They're more likely to miss school. And those who end up transferring are suspended more often. These are all consequences of eviction. It says here, school children threatened with eviction, which sounds like a strange phrase until you know that evictions name the children often. I don't know about in Montana, but they're actually named in the complaint as defendants. So, like, just think about that. Child custody. A national study found that 10% of child removals, 10% of all child removals, are due to inadequate housing. That's probably an understatement too, because a lot of the removals, that's a factor. It may not be the single reason why, but instability of housing can lead you to lose your children. And the one, you know, that I think everyone understands, homelessness, eviction leading to homelessness. In Iowa, 30% of the emergency shelter requests were due to eviction, which actually is low. And in Columbus, Ohio, which just passed a right to counsel, the homeless shelter cost per person is $15,000 a year. That's low. It's more like 30 or 35 in some of the cities we work with. $35,000 a year to put someone in a shelter versus paying for a lawyer that is for an eviction that's completely 100% avoidable. These are things that we basically make the argument for. The next really important piece is the evidence. We have seen coming out of right to counsel programs that these work. We knew this before, by the way. We didn't need Right to Counsel to know that tenant representation makes a difference. There had been studies done for decades that showed that they change results, but I'm going to give you some numbers from the Right to Counsel jurisdictions. So one statistic is how many tenants stay in their unit as a result of getting counsel. New York City, it's between 72 and 93% of the tenants. In San Francisco, it's 63%. In Boulder, it's 59%. In Toledo, it's 88%. In Washington State, it's 56%. In Kansas City, it's 86%. In Detroit, it's 46%. In different jurisdictions, it's going to be higher or lower because of a variety of factors, like the law is really bad in some places. But the point is that you're seeing tenants, not an insignificant chunk, staying in their homes. Now, not every tenant wants to stay in their home. So like that's not necessarily the goal of a lawyer. The lawyer's job is to do what the tenant asks them to do. And the tenant may say, look, I don't want this unit anymore. I just want out. And I want to get out of here without destroying my chances of finding future housing. So here, let's talk about some of those statistics. In New York, Cleveland, 88% of the tenants who wanted more time to move got it. In New Orleans, it was 30%. And in Louisville, not only did 97% of the tenants get more than the statutory minimum for time to move, but it was enough time to find alternative housing in all of those cases. So basically, it was making a huge, it wasn't just buying time, it was actually avoiding the consequence of homelessness. Getting an eviction on your record, this is called the Scarlet E in the housing world, because if you get an eviction on your record, it stays with you for a very long time. So in Boulder, 96% of the tenants who were represented avoided an eviction on their record, in 97% in Denver. In Baltimore and Maryland, we saw significant reductions in the amount of money that tenants were ordered to pay their landlords. In Baltimore, the program saved about $845,000. That avoided $845,000 of cost to landlords. In statewide in Maryland, it was about $4.5 million that was avoided. We've also started to see in some places that eviction filings are going down as a result of this, because some of those evictions should never have been filed in the first place. And the only reason they're filed is because there's no resistance. It's so easy, the minute a tenant falls behind, to just file the eviction, get a quick judgment, and go on. But once there's a right to counsel, and they actually have to prove their case, and there's actually defenses are asserted, and they have to actually follow the procedures outlined in the law, well, that changes things. In New York City, since the implementation of right to counsel, there's been a 49% drop in eviction filings. In Connecticut, 47% of the tenants who came to legal aid saying, I'm trying to avoid an eviction filing, were able to do so. That's just an incredible statistic. We talked a little bit about health. There was a study done recently that found that right to counsel improved birth outcomes for pregnant women. This is not something that we ever perceived as a benefit of right to counsel, but they actually found a measurable difference in tenants who got counsel and those who didn't in terms of healthier births with fewer complications. And a company called Stout, which has done analyses of all of these programs, has found over and over again that over 90% of the tenants who are represented avoid what they call disruptive displacement. A disruptive displacement means the sheriff comes and puts you out, puts your belongings on the street. It's violent. You lose all your things. It's traumatic. And what Stout found is that across the board, all these programs are avoiding that consequence. It's not happening to tenants. But when there isn't counsel, that is the default in most places of what happens to tenants. I could talk for a lot longer, but I just wanted to give you, like, there are so many justifications. And I think that's why we're seeing this wave of passages around the country. That and also the data, like, it's working. It's evidence-based. It works. It's not terribly expensive when you compare it to the cost of not doing it. In some of these jurisdictions, they found that for every dollar they spend on right to counsel, it saves like at least $3 or $4. And of all the costs that you just heard, like mental health treatment, shelters, police, think about this. You have to pay for police to arrest people, and then you have to pay for a jail to incarcerate them. You have to pay for a prosecutor to prosecute them. You avoid all of that if you just have a lawyer help them either stay in the home or help them preserve their stability by transitioning. That's what we're seeing. The last thing I will tell you is we are seeing right now a wave across the country of what they call preemption. And if you're not familiar with preemption, it's basically a state telling cities you're not allowed to do something, like say, taking the power away from them. We've seen this happen all over the country with things like rent control, with just cause eviction, basically saying to cities you're not allowed to pass a law requiring just cause for eviction, for rental inspections, for source of income discrimination, saying you're not allowed to pass a law prohibiting source of income discrimination. All over the country, you've seen these laws all passing all over the country. Right to counsel has not yet been targeted by any state. It has not been named in any preemption law so far. And part of the reason we think that, again, is because this issue has become so mainstream, so basic, so much understood as just fundamental fairness, just makes sense. If the landlords all come to court without counsel, why wouldn't the tenants? It doesn't make sense to deny that to them. It's just common sense. And I think that's why we're not seeing that pushback at the state level. And also landlords, are seeing the benefits. Once these programs are implemented, they're seeing the benefit of the tenants having counsel. It's making their lives easier. And the courts are also seeing the benefits. They're seeing it go better for them. The clerks who have to deal with pro se litigants, that's not an easy job for them. Dealing with a lot of people coming to the court who don't know what's going on, who are panicked. If there's a lawyer involved, they don't have to deal with like a huge wave of pro se unrepresented tenants. So I'm going to be excited to hear the rest of the panel. I'm really excited to see all of you. We're really excited to see Bozeman become the 27th jurisdiction with right to counsel, hopefully, if Akron doesn't beat you there. I'm just saying. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John. And thank you for the 10-hour plane ride from Alabama to Bozeman. We really, really appreciate it. So now we're going to move to the panel to kind of get all of our questions answered about right to counsel. And I have the pleasure of introducing our panelists. First is Connie Howell. Connie is a 25-year member of the Bozeman community. She has a long history of civic engagement and is a proud mother, wife, and grandmother. Connie has now held a seat on the core leadership of Bozeman Tenants United for the last 2 years. And is one of the leaders in the tenant union who is currently running our campaign for right to counsel. Next is Amy Hall. Amy is an attorney with Montana Legal Services Association, a nonprofit law firm based in Helena that provides civil legal assistance to Montanans statewide who cannot afford private attorneys. Amy graduated from law school in 1990 and has worked in public interest law her entire career, first in Texas, then in Montana. Since 2006, her primary focus has been representing low-income renters and landlord-tenant disputes throughout Montana. And I feel like if we're noting travel time, Amy drove all the way from Helena. So that I feel like that should be said. Next, I'm honored to introduce Brian Geyer. Brian directs emergency and supportive housing for HRDC, serving Gallatin, Park, and Marr counties. With 20 years in affordable housing, he began with eviction prevention at United Way of Salt Lake, then developed affordable housing in Park City, Utah. In his 10th year with HRDC, he now oversees the sole emergency shelters in Gallatin and Park counties. He and his team manage a family transitional housing facility, an unhoused youth facility, and Housing First Village, Montana's first permanent supportive housing facility. Late this summer, HRDC will inaugurate Homeward Point, Bozeman's first purpose-built shelter, aiming to make homelessness in our community rare, brief, and one time. Next is Charlie Cromwell. Charlie is a Bozeman-based attorney and a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve JAG Corps. A Harvard graduate and former Division I athlete, he served 4 years on active duty with the Army's 1st Infantry Division, including a 13-month tour in Iraq. After earning law and public administration graduate degrees at University of Montana, Charlie worked as a fellow for Senator Max Baucus before joining Cromwell Law. He teaches a graduate-level business course at MSU and serves on several community boards. Charlie focuses his practice on business law, estate planning, and is the outgoing director of MSU's Legal Services Program. Last, but definitely not least, we have Joey Morrison. In fall, Joey Morrison became the youngest mayoral candidate and first tenant to be elected mayor of the city of Bozeman. Currently, he serves as the deputy mayor per the city's charter and spends his time focusing on issues related to housing, renter protections, and various other aspects of local government that better serve the working people of Bozeman. Prior to running for office, Joey spent his professional career working with vulnerable populations in domestic and sexual violence advocacy and working with individuals experiencing homelessness. Now, to kind of kick off the panel, I'm going to pass it to Amy Hall. We heard from John about a lot of statistics about eviction nationally, and I want to pass it to Amy to talk about what the process of eviction looks like in Montana. How does it go from start to finish?
First, I just have to give kudos to Bozeman Tenants United. I've been in Helena since 2002, doing primarily housing advocacy with renters since 2006. We've never had a tenants union really to speak of anywhere in Montana. And now we've got you guys. We've got one in Missoula. There's one forming in Kalispell and in Helena. But the work that you guys are doing is amazing. And the fact that most of you are volunteers, so hats off to you. And all of you who came today on a Sunday afternoon in Bozeman. Who does that? But you're here. So thank you for your passion for this issue. And I get passionate, but I'm not going to cry. It's silly. I don't know why. But I'm very passionate about housing advocacy. So let me tell you what the legal landscape is for evictions. When Olive asked me to do this presentation, I wanted to make sure that you all know the process that landlords have to go through to evict you if you're on that course, and hopefully you're not. But what we see at Montana Legal Services is a lot of tenants don't know they can stay in their rental if their landlord gives them a letter telling them they have to vacate. They think they have no choice, no way to raise defenses, no choice but to move, and that's just not true. Let me tell you what the process is. First, your landlord has to start by giving you a written notice. Let's say you're a month-to-month renter and they don't really have a reason, and that's legal, unfortunately. If you're a month-to-month renter, they can just give you a 30-day notice to move for no reason. You could have been a perfect tenant for 30 years or more, and they can still evict you if you have a month-to-month rental. So you get this letter, right? And it says you got to move in 30 days. No reason given. What do? You do not have to move. Okay? If you take nothing else from what I say today, you do not have to move just because you get a letter from your landlord. If you have defenses, for example, in Bozeman, I know because we talked to Bozeman tenants, there's some kind of shoddy construction in this town of rentals. And sometimes the plumbing doesn't work. Sometimes your heat doesn't work. You may have a defense to eviction, even if you're a month-to-month tenant. If your landlord hasn't fixed your heat and you gave the landlord a written notice saying, hey, my heat's not working, and that notice happened within the last 6 months, Montana issues or has a presumption that if a landlord is evicting you within 6 months of when you made a request for repair, that could be presumed retaliation. What does that mean? That means the landlord cannot evict you on a 30-day notice for no reason. So you have a defense. So what do then if your landlord sent you a notice and you don't want to move and your heater's still not fixed? What I hear from landlords all the time is communication is key with your landlord. And I hate to agree with the Landlords Association on that one, but it's kind of true. You know, if you get a notice from your landlord and you've got defenses and you still don't have heat, talk to your landlord and say, look, let's work something out here. You need to fix my heat. Maybe you're willing to move, but you need more time or whatever. But talk to your landlord if you get a notice and you want to stay.
Hey, Amy.
Yes.
Can you walk us through like step by step? So the landlord files.
So we're getting to the filing. So let's say you can't work out anything with your landlord because they're unreasonable. They want you out. Then the landlord's only option is to file a court lawsuit against you. They can't shut you out. They can't shut off your utilities. They can't change your locks. They can't have you arrested because you refuse to move in 30 days. The only thing the landlord can do is file an eviction lawsuit against you. If they do that, then they have to get you personally served with the lawsuit papers. That means somebody, a process server or a sheriff's deputy, comes and physically hands you copies of the landlord's court papers. They could hand you those papers anywhere. You could be at the bar. You could be at your work. You could be at home. You could be anywhere in the park. Anywhere they can find you, they hand you those papers. From the date you receive them, you have 5 business days to file a response with the court, a written answer with the court. I know, right? That's not very long. 5 business days means you don't count Saturdays, Sundays, or legal holidays. The legislature just reduced it. It used to be you had 10 business days, but not this session, but last session, they reduced it to 5. And they wanted to do just 5 calendar days, but at least clearer heads prevailed and they did 5 business days. So what does that mean? You got to file an answer. I did bring, and Olive made copies of some sample answers and summons and complaints. So you'll get served with a summons that says, you've been sued, you have 5 days to file a written answer, and you have to pay $30 for filing your answer. What if you don't have the $30 to pay the court when you file your answer? What they don't tell you on the summons is you can ask the court to waive that $30 filing fee, which means you don't have to pay it. You have to fill out a statement of your income and expenses. The judge reviews it. If the judge thinks you can't afford the $30, then you don't have to pay it, and you can still file your answer. But a lot of clients we see, they don't file their answer because they didn't have the $30, and they didn't know there was the option to get it waived. And the legislature, I wish they would pass something saying the summons has to tell people that if you can't afford the answer fee, talk to the clerk and ask that it be waived. But we've never gotten that passed. So once you do, let's say you're on it and you get your answer filed within 5 days, the next thing that happens, and in my example, if you haven't had heat, that's where you raise your defense. Hey, they can't evict me. Even if it's a no-cause eviction, they can't evict me because I raised the fact that I haven't had heat.
And Amy, just to pause you here, because people might not know, like, what needs to be in the written defense and what happens if everything that you need to include in the written defense isn't there when you're in court?
So in this example, with a 30-day no-cause notice, in your answer, you have to raise some kind of defense, because otherwise, if you don't, then the landlord, who almost always has a lawyer, that lawyer will file something called a motion for judgment on the pleadings, saying that you didn't raise any defenses to this 30-day no-cause notice, so therefore you lose and the landlord wins. So Olive is exactly right. You have to raise some kind of defense, and it cannot be just, my kids are in school and it would hurt them to have to change schools, or I'm a person with disabilities and I shouldn't be evicted on a 30-day no-cause notice. None of those things are legal defenses. You have to raise a legal defense like retaliation for requesting repairs or something like that. Discrimination. If you're a person with disabilities and you're the only one who's being evicted in your building, maybe there's some discrimination there. So you can raise that kind of defense. But if you don't raise any defense in your answer, you lose automatically. You won't even get a hearing.
Do you feel tenants just on their own are equipped to write a written legal defense?
No, unfortunately. Some are, but not many. Because like has been mentioned, I think Olive in her opening comments, those of us who are lawyers or landlords, we speak legal. Right? We get it. We know how the process works. Tenants who have never been to court for any reason, they don't speak legal. And even if you're a smart person, it just doesn't come naturally, the things that you have to do when you file in court. A tenant in Bozeman filed her own answer to a lawsuit, basically saying, well, I'm having some challenges right now and I shouldn't be evicted because I'm going to be going to treatment. Is that a legal defense? No, it's not. She could have lost automatically, even though our hearts go out to her, right? But the landlord's heart doesn't. The judge's heart won't. The judge has to follow the law, and that's not a legal reason. But she made her way to Montana Legal Services and we represented her. The example of our answer, which was, yeah, she is behind on the rent, but there is reason for that. And here are defenses to that. Landlords charging these crazy late fees. How many of you have crazy late fees, right? All landlords are charging them now. So this client was facing crazy late fees that made her balance look a lot greater than it was. What was the end result in that case where this client could have been evicted like that with no hearing? She came to legal aid, she got a lawyer, and we ended up settling it. Out of court, no hearing, she got to stay. And she had to pay her rent, but we were able to access resources to help her get the rent paid. So lawyers for tenants make a difference. That's why we're all here. I wish it didn't have to be like that. In my own populist view, I think tenants should be able to represent themselves and mire through the system and do a good job and end up not being evicted. But that's not the legal system that we exist in right now. Once you file your answer, The judge of Montana has to set a hearing within 10 days and will mail you a notice of that hearing. So if you decided to move after you filed your answer before the hearing was set, you may not even get notice of the hearing. If you don't show up at the hearing, you're going to lose then too. So there's so many ways that the landlord can win and you could lose if you don't have a lawyer looking out for you. What happens at the hearing? Judge shows up, landlord shows up with their attorney, you show up by yourself if you don't have counsel. You could bring somebody, but they can't represent you unless they're an attorney. So everybody's there at the hearing. Judge looks at the landlord and says, okay, landlord, you're the plaintiff. You go first. Plaintiff says, well, I just gave him a 30-day notice. I don't have to have a reason. They're a month-to-month renter. Period. End of statement. Then it's up to you as the tenant to put on your defenses. You've got to have proof that your heater doesn't work, that you gave notice to the landlord that the heater didn't work within the last 6 months, and that the landlord still hasn't fixed it. And how are you supposed to know all that? We do have a great website, MontanaLawHelp.org, MontanaLawHelp.org. It has a bunch of legal information that tells you everything that I've just told you. But if you didn't know to go to the website, you wouldn't know to raise those kinds of issues at your hearing. So then what happens? Judge hears the whole hearing. Usually the judge will say, okay, I'll take it all under advisement. Judges don't usually tell you what the result is after the hearing. They'll say, I'm going to issue a decision in writing. They have to do that within 5 business days after the hearing. And then you get something in the mail which says whether or not you're evicted. If you are evicted, then there will be what's called a writ of assistance or a writ of possession. That's a separate court order addressed specifically to the sheriff's deputy that says, deputy, go remove Amy Hall, the tenant, from this residence if she hasn't moved out. So deputy shows up with this piece of paper, and if you're still there, the deputy's going to say, you got to get out. You lost in court. You do have appeal rights. You have the option to file a motion for relief from judgment if there are grounds from that. But tenants don't know all of this, and so they end up moving. And often if they're excluded from the home by a writ, that means they don't have time. Sometimes the deputy will give you 15 minutes to gather what you can, get out. All the rest of your stuff is left in the rental. And then you got to deal with the landlord to try to get your stuff out. And if they're not reasonable, that can be a challenge. You could lose everything. So the stakes are high. That's why it's so important for you to know your rights, what happens if you get a notice, and contact a lawyer, Montana Legal Services or Charlie or somebody, because you'll get a better outcome if you have representation.
Or have a right to counsel.
Yes, of course, right to counsel, of course.
Thank you so much, Amy. Our next question is for Connie. When we're talking about evictions, we're not just talking about numbers, but we're talking about the impact that it has on people and the communities that they're connected to. Connie, can you tell me a little bit about what you think about this question?
When you're talking about this issue, it's a personal issue for me. 20 years ago, we were evicted from our home, and it was a retaliation for a case the landlord lost to a neighbor that I testified in. We were homeless for 6 months. We bounced between friends' homes, and then we ended up staying in the National Forest Campground for 2 months before we moved here to Bozeman. We couldn't afford an attorney to stay where we were at because we probably would have had a good case against our landlord for retaliation, but we couldn't afford an attorney, so we ended up being homeless. There are health impacts, just as John had talked about. I was recovering from a 4-car pileup where I had a closed head injury, and it put back my recovery from the stress of not knowing where I was going to be and the stress of how it was affecting my daughter. Sorry. And my husband. It put a strain on our marriage. The impact on our daughter. Our daughter was about 9 years old at the time. She went to 2 different schools that year. She left friends in one behind, made new friends, and had to leave them behind. Then we had to leave where we were at and leave family behind to come to a new place. So within 1 year, she started 3 schools. And now, as an adult, she's still scared to death of being homeless. There's a financial impact, as Amy was talking about. I had a small business, bird breeding business, and I was working into selling doll clothes to people who could afford to buy doll clothes. And I lost all of that in the move because we lost our storage area. We couldn't afford to keep it. Between the moving costs, the costs here of filing for contracts to get into a place with management companies, we lost over $10,000. That's the cost of a down payment on a house. And that was within a year. Current impact right now is that I'm hypervigilant around my landlord. I have no reason to be. He hasn't given me any reason to be, but I am. I'm very circumspect in what I talk to him about and how long I'm around him. And I always have a fear of being homeless and being evicted.
We got your back, Connie. How do you feel like having a right to counsel in Bozeman would impact your life and then in the lives of your neighbors?
I've actually seen a couple of people get evicted, not from my apartment complex, thankfully, but I do know a couple of people that got evicted. It's a violent act. It's a violent act mentally and emotionally because you're forced out of your home. You're forced out of that place that you feel safe in, and you're no longer safe. And with the right to counsel, that helplessness that you feel, because it is feeling of helplessness, is mitigated somewhat because you've got somebody in your corner fighting for you. And corporate landlords don't like that. They want you dumb and ignorant so you'll just go away and they can raise the rent and put the next person in there.
Thank you so much, Connie. Thank you. This next question is for Brian. The state of Montana has some of the fastest growing rates of homelessness in our entire country. Brian, you service people directly impacted by eviction. Can you speak to what you're seeing and the impact that eviction is having from your perspective?
As Olive mentioned, I run the emergency shelter here in Bozeman. We also run a smaller shelter over in Park County. And the fallout from somebody coming through our doors for the first time, coming through the doors of the shelter and actually coming to terms and coming to grips with the fact that they're going to need emergency shelter is a fraught experience. That's a scary experience for somebody to walk through the doors of that shelter the first time. That experience is compounded when the reason you're walking through the door is the culmination of months and months of work to prevent yourself from being evicted and losing that battle and having to walk through with that sort of scepter of eviction over your shoulder as you're walking through the door of a homeless shelter for the first time. It can't be described as any other way than tragic. It's horrifying. What we're seeing here in Bozeman is some pretty intense demographic shifts as well. So this is not isolated to individuals. We're seeing a pretty significant uptick in the number of families who are experiencing homelessness in our community. And more frequently, that familial homelessness is a byproduct of eviction or what happens in our community. It's always been a culture of Bozeman and the surrounding area. It's always kind of been a month-to-month community because we have the school, we have a really heavy service industry, and so those month-to-month leases, that's just been Bozeman's housing market for a long time. And what we see more regularly are people showing up with everything that they own, which is something that as a shelter you just can't prepare for. Somebody coming through your door who is literally everything that they own is in the vehicle that they are parking in the shelter parking lot. And right now it's also not just evictions. Because of this month-to-month culture that exists here in Bozeman, we also see a lot of people who've been given a notice from their landlord saying, I'm going to shift it to a night-by-night rental or I'm going to raise the rent by this much. You have 30 days. That's a de facto eviction in our community right now just because of the nature of the housing market. That's a de facto eviction. And so for our guests to have something like a right to counsel, maybe that prevents them from just accepting that 30-day notice and saying that I'm going to vacate this property because I have no legal defense. And so to shift that, at least that small perspective of there might be a ray of hope if there's an attorney here that's going to help me navigate this, maybe I won't take this 30-day notice as the default truth and I need to leave this home. And that ray of hope has so much power for our guests. And finally, I'll sum it up with the solution to homelessness is housing. And if we, through tenants' right to counsel, through programs that divert people and intervene before they ever experience homelessness, the outcomes on the back end are so much greater. The solution to homelessness is housing. And this is just one way to accomplish that goal.
Thanks, Brian. Brian, can you speak to how eviction keeps people on the streets and kind of prevents people from getting back into housing?
It's the Scarlet E. We know that it looms over people's heads for the rest of their lives. It's a cardinal sin in Bozeman's housing market to have an eviction on your record. It basically shuts down all opportunities and for somebody who's at the shelter, it's so much easier to support them when they're experiencing housing instability and maintain that housing versus losing that housing, coming to the shelter and having to completely rebuild. Homelessness is hard work. It is extremely taxing, not just mentally, but physically. But when you have an eviction that you're trying to navigate, also monetarily, it is expensive to get to yourself back to a place where anybody will consider renting to you. And so it looms over their head very much like the Scarlet E. So I appreciate your term there.
Yeah, Brian's exactly right. Anytime there's a court case filed against you in court, that's public record. I could go down to the courthouse right now. I could find out who's been served with eviction over the last week. And if you have an eviction judgment against you, a lot of property managers and landlords check those public records when you put in an application to rent someplace. So if your name comes up, what happens to your application? Thrown away right away. Doesn't matter if you paid $100 in your application fee. They're going to throw away your application and go with somebody else who hasn't had a court eviction against them. That will stay on your record forever. Once it's filed in the court and there's an eviction judgment against you, it never gets expunged or wiped out. We don't have good laws in Montana that allow you to easily undo a court judgment against you. So that's another reason why right to counsel is so important, to keep those evictions off your record. Even if you end up moving, like in the month-to-month example I gave, maybe you agree to move out in 60 days instead of 30. That could all be arranged, and it's easier to negotiate if you have landlord's counsel talking to tenant's counsel. Then once the court case is filed, if they've already filed it, you could just get it dismissed without an eviction. So a dismissal is much better for tenants than the eviction judgment.
Thanks for that, Amy.
One more thing. Some of the landlord software now doesn't even distinguish between whether you had an eviction filed or you had an eviction against you, like you actually lost. They don't care. If you just had an eviction filed, sometimes that's all it takes to get kicked out, even if you won the eviction, which is why reducing the number of filings, like the people that are getting filed against them, is so important, because that filing alone can be the damage.
That's why we have you here, John. I'm going to pass it to Charlie to answer this next question. Critics of right to counsel have said that right to counsel will negatively impact landlords. How would you respond to that?
Absurd. But let me do a quick tangent, because I think I want to add to John's list of demographics that are entitled to right to counsel. And it may have sounded a little bizarre. I put all that, well, actually, AI put that military background in my 100-word generated bio. But soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marine all have right to counsel. They all have legal assistance attorneys who are JAGs that jump in and help them if someone is trying to evict them or punish them for terminating a lease early because they're getting deployed. They all get JAGs. So right to counsel exists in our military. So add that to your list. And I've done that as a legal assistance attorney as a JAG. But yes, absurd. Mostly it's just based on a false, absurd premise that in our adversarial system, which John talked about and Amy talked about, it presumes everyone is represented by counsel. That's how it works. That's how it becomes fair. That's how you have equitable outcomes, is when one party has a lawyer arguing for him and another party has a lawyer arguing for him. You just heard Amy walk through, that was tip of the iceberg when it comes to eviction proceedings. There's substantive law in there, and there's also procedural law, and there is just no way someone in 5 business days can pick that up just by reading a pamphlet or even using ChatGPT Esquire. It's just impossible. And you need a lawyer there to advocate for you. And then you have a fair and equitable outcome. So that is the answer to your question, absurd.
Can you talk to me a little bit about how you see how right to counsel might actually benefit some smaller landlords who are filing an eviction?
And here I'll put on my ASMSU legal services hat, because I've been running that program now for over a decade. You may have experienced this if you ever saw any of our lawyers up on campus. We have had fantastic outcomes with landlords when you look at it over the course of this decade. And I just have anecdotal examples of it. I was very thankful for John bringing all the data and the stats. And I can say we're anecdotally very similar to that. But a lot of the time it's education, which leads to prevention of future problems. Educating not only our student clients, but also the landlords. Because we have landlords that run the spectrum. Everything from the unsavory corporate landlord that this is just a transaction, it's not dealing with people and their families, to a new landlord or a new property management company, maybe it's like a second home that they bought here and they just want to rent it out. They come from a different jurisdiction. They don't understand Montana landlord-tenant law. So they have unfavorable terms in leases that are arguably not legal. They observe practices that may have worked in the jurisdiction they came from that don't work here. And it's not malicious. They just don't understand and they don't know. When you have a lawyer who's familiar with Montana Landlord-Tenant Act, can educate them, and the student client comes in and they're like, oh my God, I got this letter that I'm getting evicted. And we look at it and we talk about it and like, oh, that actually isn't in compliance with Montana law. We call the landlord and we explain what's going on. We explain the law and they're like, oh, geez, I didn't realize that was the case. We had a lot of great outcomes with these new, and this happens in Bozeman a lot, new landlords that are coming to town, new homeowners that just don't understand the law. So that goes a long way. Just having the lawyer who's knowledgeable, has some street cred because they have an Esquire behind their name, just talking to the landlord. And they understand, okay, there's some authority there. That's one part of it. Another thing that was brought up is the ability to negotiate, because a lot of the time these notices to evict, it's an opportunity to cure an issue that the landlord is stating that the tenant breached the lease for. The tenant may not understand that, and they're like, oh my God, I'm getting evicted. And you look at it and you're like, oh, there was just one little thing that the landlord wanted you to do. You're in breach of your lease, but hey, we can fix this. I'll let the landlord know. And then that ability to evict or even that need to evict will disappear. So the lawyer can help with that. They can help negotiate with the landlord, maybe get a little more time to cure that issue with the lease. So that's a big one. And then the last thing that we've noticed, getting to the more unsavory landlords who are repeat offenders or that, again, it's just transactional. They don't think they're dealing with people, is precedent setting. So when a landlord knows that they're going against an MSU student and that MSU student has access to legal services and they have some pretty good lawyers, if I don't say so myself, we have some great landlord-tenant lawyers that work with us at ASMSU, are on the other side, they will back down. And they will know that this is not going to be something that they can just easily jam through the court without a fight or without somebody advocating for the tenant. They will usually back down and will come to an outcome that both parties can live with. So that's the last piece that I think is very helpful, having a lawyer involved.
Thanks, Charlie.
One thing that's implicit in what Charlie just said is that we see it too at Montana Legal Services. If a tenant has representation, cases settle. There will be no hearing. There will be no court judgment. Why? Because the landlords, even if they're represented, they don't want to pay their attorney to duke it out with lawyers who are as good as Charlie and me in court. You know, it's just not worth it to get rid of little you who's a month-to-month tenant. It's just, in the long term, not worth it for a landlord to spend a whole bunch of money on attorney's fees to try to get you out, when hopefully the landlord will lose anyway because we've raised such great defenses for you, which you didn't even know existed. So right to counsel is just so important for so many reasons, including getting cases settled with no hearing and getting them dismissed so there is no eviction judgment.
Thanks for that additional flavor, Amy. Critics of right to counsel have said that these services already exist for tenants. Montana Legal Services Association is the sole legal aid provider in the state of Montana. How would you respond to that?
That is true. Montana Legal Services is the only zero-cost law firm for tenants in the whole state. There's one other organization called Disability Rights Montana that represents people for free, but only people with disabilities, and they generally don't do eviction cases. So it's true. MLSA exists to represent Montanans in poverty in all kinds of civil legal matters. We don't do criminal defense, but we do housing, anything civil, domestic violence, family law, consumer law. We can do any of those civil cases, and we do not charge our clients. So some critics say, well, why do we need right to counsel then if we already have this source of free legal services? And the reason is because we're woefully underfunded, just like all legal aid offices throughout the country. Plus, our income thresholds to qualify for Montana Legal Services. If you make, as a single person, more than $31,000 per year, you're not eligible for legal assistance, right? That's not very much. That's an hourly wage of $1,505 per hour. For a family of three, you have to make under $53,300 a year. So, you know, how many families in Bozeman especially qualify for legal services? Not very many. So that's another factor. But because we are a statewide law firm, we're a nonprofit law firm, we have offices only in Missoula, Billings, and Helena, and that's to try to reduce our overhead. I'd love to have an office in Bozeman and do nothing but housing, and maybe that would happen if Right to Counsel passes. But right now, we don't have an office in Bozeman. We still serve Bozeman residents, but you have to contact us through the website or through our helpline, a toll-free number. I talked a little bit about our ratio. I had to ask my people what our current ratio is. We have 3 offices. We have 13 attorneys statewide to represent all low-income Montanans in every kind of civil legal matter. 3 of our 13 attorneys are housing attorneys and can represent tenants. But what that means is we have about 1 attorney in Montana for every eligible 8,600 Montanans. So how are we going to represent every Bozeman resident who gets an eviction notice? We're not, without additional funding, and that's where Right to Counsel comes in.
Thanks, Amy.
KGVM Bozeman.
I'm going to take us to our final question of the night, and this is going to be also last but not least again for Joey. One question that we get all the time about Right to Counsel is, how is this going to be paid for? The biggest concern that we hear from homeowners about Right to Counsel is that their property taxes will be increased. That's a fear for tenants too, because when property taxes increase, our landlords increase our rent. What would you say to somebody who has this fear about rising property taxes?
Thank you for that question. It's one that we at the City Commission, we deal with every day. Certainly the commission, and I can absolutely vouch for our city manager and our legal counsel, we are always trying to make the most fiduciarily responsible decision. What are the things that we can be doing to make sure that the tax dollars that are paid for by the people that have enshrined authority in us, make sure that their dollars go as far as possible, and we take that charge very seriously. We take that discernment into account when we're making policy decisions, when we're making quasi-judicial decisions, when we're thinking about staffing and hiring and things like that. So this, to me, actually sits right in a good opportunity of an extremely surgical use of fairly modest tax dollars to yield quite large results. We got to hear from John Pollock saying, hey, cities that have passed this, they say for every $1 they've invested, and I think from the FAQ on the NCCRC's website, shows some jurisdictions have shown $3 of returns, $4 of returns, some have shown as high as $12 of returns. So as we think about what is the most responsible use of our tax dollars, we know that we as a community, we cannot afford to turn our backs on the most vulnerable people in our community when they are in positions of great need. And we need to do what we can to shut that faucet off, to stop the production of downstream impacts, to stop people from ending up on our streets. And so when I think about the housing challenges that are in front of us in Bozeman, I like to think of it in 3 buckets. One bucket is, how do we transition people who are in either unsafe or unhoused situations into safe and permanent housing options? That's one bucket. Another bucket is, how do we generate and get actual permanently affordable units online? That's a separate bucket. And then a third bucket is, how do we keep the people who are currently stably housed forever? And this obviously attributes to that ambition. We know that we need to expand what it means to be safe as a community. We know that people in our community, when they have their needs met, when they are stably housed, when they have the resources that they need, it makes all of us as a community safer. When our neighbors have what they need, we are safer for it. And housing is absolutely a slice of what makes our community safe. And so as much as I do hear constituents say, hey, we're drowning in property taxes, some of which, yes, the city can be blamed for that. Over nearly a decade now, property taxes have been increasing from a variety of factors, not just the city of Bozeman. Not going to get into that here. But the other thing that we consistently hear from our constituents is, we want you to invest in things that make our community safer. We want to feel safe walking up and down the street. We want to be safe going into our parks. We want to be safe recreating in this community. And to me, we need to expand what it means to be safe, what it means to invest in public safety. It does not just mean investing in emergency services. It has to mean investing in the upstream solutions that keep folks from needing emergency services ever to begin with. A few other pieces that I just want to hit home that are somewhat in response to public comments that we've received over the last couple months and public comments that we received this time last year as we were thinking about this project. One is this distinction of who is a taxpayer and who is not a taxpayer. Everybody in this room is a taxpayer. Do not let somebody take away from you because you are a tenant that you are not a taxpayer. You are a taxpayer, you just don't get the credit for it. When I pay rent every month, I send it to my landlord, and my landlord pays his property tax off of the money I sent to him. He then gets to say, well, my tenant doesn't pay any property taxes. This system actually comes up constantly in public comments that we receive at the commission. A lot of the public comments saying, don't do this, have been from folks saying, I pay property taxes and tenants don't. Therefore, you should not center services that center tenants over me. And we get to hear that kind of rhetoric all the time. And it is based in just unabashed classism of who gets to be a legitimate taxpayer in our community and who doesn't. So don't let anybody take the righteous right of taxpayerness away from you. The other piece is just really wanting to hit home what a few people have already talked about, but I carry the stories of tenants that I talked with while I was running for office, as well as folks that I talked with at the shelter when I was working there, of doing intakes with folks who had thousands of dollars in their bank account. They had the money to pay rent, but they got denied and denied and denied because they had an eviction on their record, or because they had a violent crime on their record, or because they just didn't even have good rental history, not even an eviction. And that kept them out of housing. This is the other part of the story of homelessness that so few people are willing to acknowledge in this community. It's not just, can you afford rent? It's, do you have a shiny rental history without a blemish on it? Because you're going to be competing with somebody like me, who has great rental history, who's got a shiny resume, and doesn't raise any alarms with a landlord. That's who our unhoused neighbors are competing with to get out of the cycle of poverty and the cycle of homelessness. Isn't just, can they afford rent? Can they afford a security deposit? It's all these structural pieces that can keep someone in this cycle for the rest of their lives. And we know that this is one of the tools that has been proven across the country to be a sound investment for a municipality to take, as well as actually produce the outcomes that we endeavor to take. And that is why January 26th of 2024, when 2 weeks after I was sworn in, I fought hard to make sure that this is a priority that the City Commission would explore. And here we are almost a year and a half later, and hopefully seeing this be able to come in front of us. The other piece that I want to just commit to is we've said all throughout, we don't want this to be something that we have to add additional mills from the city budget, which means more property taxes, or a levy. This is something that we are trying to figure out how we can finance the existing general fund budget. Things that we are already saying, hey, we've moved money to do this thing before. Maybe that's not what we want it to anymore. Let's try this thing instead. We are committed as a city to making sure that this does not get to be passed down to future tenants, because at the end of the day, tenants are taxpayers. So if we have to increase property taxes for anybody to fund this program, that just gets passed down to renters anyway. So that's, at the end of the day, not a priority that we have. I am committing to making sure that this is a gentle and surgical use of our budget as possible, because we know the stakes are high for a lot of people in our community. When we hear about fixed income seniors getting priced out of this community, we take that really seriously. We know that this program will benefit everybody in this community, not just tenants, because it makes our community safer. But we want it to be gentle, and we want it to be a really surgical use of our tax dollars. And that's a big part of why I think the argument that this isn't a good use of public dollars is phooey. It does not make any sense. This is a really, really effective and surgical use of our dollars.
Thanks, Joey. And can I get a big round of applause for all of our panelists up here? Can I get another round of applause for all of our city commissioners, Douglas Fisher, Emma Bodie, Joey Morrison, who are here tonight? Thank you for your support for tenants, and thank you for being a part of our community. Right now, we are at an unprecedented moment in our country with huge wealth disparities, with our housing increasingly being owned by corporations who are also rapidly consolidating. Given the political landscape nationally, now more than ever, it's important that our local government be stalwart champions of working people in Bozeman, protecting our rights, our homes, and our livelihoods. The city has the opportunity to fund a right to counsel on June 10th. And right now they're having a work session in just a week on May 13th, where they will be discussing tenant right to counsel. For us in the room as citizens of Bozeman, now more than ever, it's important that we take initiative and participate in our local government. And we need a diversity of people, not just tenants, to show up in support of right to counsel and give public comment directly to the city commissioners. Yeah, we really need that. People who are threatened by tenants having a fair shot in court will be turning out against this, and it's really important that we show that this community is overwhelmingly in support of fairness, in support of protecting our most vulnerable members of our community and keeping tenants in their homes. So please raise your hand if you would be willing to be at the meeting on May 13th and give public comment in support of Tenant Right to Counsel. That's great. There's also an opportunity to submit written public comment ahead of time through email if you can't make it on that Tuesday night. Right to counsel is critical for our community. The only way that we've gotten this far is by tenants standing shoulder to shoulder and working together to fight for what we need. And there is so much more that we need to ensure that everyone in Bozeman is living in safe, dignified, and affordable housing, which many of us are not right now. Every tenant deserves a union. That includes our neighbors who are living out on the streets. That includes our neighbors who are bank tenants, who are paying off their mortgage, who can also become members of our tenant union. The message that I guess I want to leave you guys on tonight is that what impacts one of us impacts all of us. Every tenant in Bozeman who's being evicted, that is having a widespread effect on our entire community, on the safety of our community, and our collective health. Keeping tenants in our homes benefits the safety and health of our entire community. It's not just about tenants. And so, yeah, that's the note that I want to leave you on. Thanks for coming out.
You have just heard an informational panel hosted by Bozeman Tenants United held on May 4th, 2025 about their campaign to institute a tenant's right to counsel in Bozeman. It featured John Pollack, coordinator of the National Coalition for the Civil Rights to Counsel, who had just flown in from Alabama, Bozeman Tenants United organizer Connie Howell, Montana Legal Services Association's Senior Attorney for Housing Amy Hall, Brian Geyer, HRDC's Emergency and Supportive Housing Director, Charlie Cromwell, Managing Partner of Cromwell Law, as well as MSU Adjunct Professor, who has been providing legal services via the ASMSU Legal Services Program, and Bozeman Deputy Mayor Joey Morrison. The panel was moderated by Bozeman Tenants United Campaigns Director Olive Sohn. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on KGVM Bozeman. Your financial support allows us to continue bringing you programs of community interest and concern. It was this weekend in 2018 that Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM, first broadcast. Since then, this entirely volunteer staff station has been bringing you local and nationally produced public affairs programs like Forthright Radio and Human Capital, the Tom Hartman Report, Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, or Your Call, or the Health and Happiness Show, or the Shortwave Report, bringing international perspectives, and of course, all the music programs you've come to enjoy. Here's the thing, though. Community radio means that it's up to this community to fund the equipment, electricity, studio and transmitter rentals, etc. So we do appreciate all those who have supported the station since we began broadcasting those 7 years ago, but we need more of you to join them. And it's easy to do. Just go to kgvm.org and click on the Gold Support KGVM button at the top of the page. There you'll find numerous ways to support the station and keep us on the air and online and bringing you quality programming of, by, and for our community. We thank you for listening and for your support.